Now, as we have progressed through this series, which we've called Studies in the Gospel According to Mark, I have tried to impress upon us the importance of bringing a proper frame of mind and awareness to this study, because for too long, Christians have read the gospel accounts of Jesus' life, his teachings, as if these things were taking place in some sort of sealed historical vacuum, outside of history and space and time. And because we have tended to read these stories and these accounts in this odd manner, it has occasionally resulted in the development of strange and heterodox beliefs and ideas. And as those beliefs, although they have become hallowed by time and frequent repetition, they are, to be honest, simply wrong. And this is nowhere more obvious than in the typical Christian view of matters relating to end times, the second coming, the last days. And the chapter that we have read, at least these first 13 verses, Mark 13, 1 to 13, along with perhaps the better known parallels in Matthew 24 and Luke 21, are a prime example of this very thing. See, the way this usually happens is you'll have a Christian who is new to the faith or new to studying the scriptures, and they will be told long before they get to any text like Mark 13 or Matthew 24 or the book of Revelation, they will be told that this is all about the last days, and they're told that the last days are in fact the days in which we live. It doesn't matter when it is, whether this is somebody in the year 1900, somebody in the year 2000, somebody in the year 1812, it's always the last days in which we are living, you know. And since that is the case, so they are told, they are to read most all of these verses in light of that very disturbing reality. And so, with all of that preloaded or front-loaded into their minds, too many Christians make the profound mistake of reading this material backwards from the 21st century. But you see, what we must do, if we are to get it right, is to read it forward from the first century. Now, I have a lot more that needs to be said about reading and understanding this material. But we need to understand that we must read Mark 12, 1 to 13, as if we were living at the time in which these things were written. And it's a time when there is nothing such as these United States, or the area of the world we know today as Europe, or any of the events of modern times. There's been no war between the states. There's been no World War I, World War II. You would have not have heard of any of the events of the past 2,000 years for that matter, because in the time in which Jesus spoke these words, none of those things that we have lived through and others have lived through had happened. Now, before we go any further in this study, we need to get out on the table two terms that will be used frequently as we come to grips with this chapter. And I will regret right here the academic nature of this part of the study, but it simply can't be avoided. These are things, if we're really going to understand what this is about, we've got to engage this. And the first of these two words is the word eschatology. Now, this is a combination of two Greek words that literally mean the study of last things or final things. And what we must do right now before thinking one more thought about this whole business is this. We've got to force ourselves to realize that as far as what we have read in Mark 13 is concerned, in terms of the mechanics and the things it describes, it has virtually nothing to do with you or me in the 21st century. And it has everything to do with the Christians and the Jews and the Greeks and the Romans who were living in the first century. And so in this case, the study of last things, eschatology, is about the future, but it is looking at the future from a specific context and from a certain perspective. That context and that perspective is largely a Hebraic, Judaistic, first century way of thinking and living and believing. And my friends, that means it is very different than a 21st century, in our case, southeastern United States way of thinking and believing and living. Now, the second one of these terms is the word apocalyptic. Now, this too is from a combining of Greek words that literally means to uncover something, to unveil something. And for the purposes of our study in this chapter, what we need to remember about this word apocalyptic is this. It specifies a particular type or style or format for writing about or speaking about end times, eschatology. And it refers to a certain way of speaking about the future within that first century Judaistic context. A way of writing, a way of talking that takes into account and incorporates all of the political and religious crises that were going on at that time. And my friends, there were many crises going on at that time in politics and religion in that place. Apocalyptic is a type of writing and thinking that is about the closing out of one era and the beginning of a new one. And it is infused with the urgent hope that God will bring this crisis to an end and a new world, a new age will be birthed into being. Now, there are several points of understanding that we need to keep handy as we continue through this study. We've gotten those two words out of the way. Let me make the following points for us to keep in mind. Remember, this is, or let me tell you, this is the first of three or four parts study in this one chapter. It's that important. First, and to say this again, the material in this chapter, and for that matter, any other part of the New Testament that is eschatological or apocalyptic writing, it is to be read forward from the first century rather than backwards from the 21st century. Friends, as easy it is for me to say that, the fact is, though, it is almost impossible for us to naturally, notice I said naturally, read this forward rather than backward. See, anytime we read this kind of material, we are reading it from the vantage of hindsight. We are sitting here, in our case, in the spring of the year 2019, and we can look back over the vast history of the Christian movement and see all these things that have happened going forward from that first century era. So we've got that hindsight. We can look and see what happened in the year AD 70. We can look and see what happened in the year 1054 and in the 16th century and the Protestant Reformation and all these kind of things. But in reality, when it comes to prophetic writings in the New Testament, this becomes a disadvantage for us in one sense. I mean, think of it this way. Hopefully this will be one of several examples I can use to help. Let's say that you're walking into a big building and there are two glass doors that you have to open to go in. They're not automatic doors. They're glass doors that you push open. And on those glass doors facing you as you walk in are words that say entrance, office building, so-and-so's office. I mean, words of information to everybody entering the building. So once you've gone through the doors, you look back and those letters are now reversed and you really can't make much sense of them. It's very hard to read them because they were not written for people coming from the opposite direction. They were written for people coming into the building. So if you're going to read them at all from the vantage point of having gone through the doors, you've got to at least imagine how it must have looked from those on the other side. In other words, you think back to how it looked to those for whom these words were written, in this case, in Mark 13. Now, another reason why we must cultivate the habit of reading this material forward rather than backward is to avoid the danger of reading our ideas back into the text. You know, a lot of Christians, they read something like chapter 13 or Matthew 24, and they think they know all about what these images and stories actually refer to. But they are reading these things after the events have taken place rather than at the time they were spoken. Maybe another way to express it is this. Our knowing what Christianity's future was and is from the point in which Mark 13 was written makes it harder for us to see and understand what they were talking about. I mean, if you really and truly want to understand what the text of Mark 13 means, then we've got to avoid the common evangelical tendency to believe that interpreting the prophetic parts of the New Testament is nothing more than matching the details of the text with what we know about history, and especially modern times. Another thing that we have to keep in mind is that our assumption must be that the content of Mark 13 relates meaningfully, It has some immediate meaning to the people in that first century setting. I think most of us have had the experience of driving on a major highway. Now, of course, here in our area, that would mean Interstate 85, Interstate 385, or Interstate I-26. And as you drive, you know, you pass these signs that give you information about what's just ahead on that highway. You may see a sign, for example, that warns you that you've come to a falling or fallen rock zone. It's just ahead. Or maybe you're coming to an intersection. There's a sign that says, exit this way. Now, think about this. What is it that makes those road signs meaningful? What is it that causes the road sign to make sense to you? Surely it is that the sign's relationship and connection with the physical thing it's describing, right? I mean, if you see a sign, say you're going up or down I-26, and it tells you, the driver, who sees it at that moment, that the main exit for Asheville is 1 mile away. Well, if there's no place called Asheville, that sign would be meaningless, wouldn't it? Would it make any sense at all to uproot that sign that says, this is the exit for Asheville, and locate it right next to the sign that says, this is the exit for Newberry, about 100 miles in the opposite direction? Of course not. And in the same way, it would not make any sense at all to go up and down I-26 and collect, say, 15 or 20 road signs and randomly just place them in different places or set them up in an area that is projected to be an extension of I-26 sometime in the future. My friends, as we read and study the words of Mark 13, we must repeatedly ask ourselves, why has this sign been placed there in that place? Right there at that juncture for those people to see and take note of. Our assumption must be that these verses had immediate meaning and relevance to the historical events as they were experienced by the communities of people for whom this writing was given and from whom it came. And here is also one of the most important things to remember in all of this. The things that we are reading in this chapter are not first and foremost little chunks of doctrinal data that somehow have become scattered all through these pages of the New Testament. That's what some people do with this. They're looking to build a particular view of the end times of eschatology, so to speak, and they pick out little chunks of doctrinal data and construct, you know, their doctrine. No, what these things are things that people said and wrote at specific moments in an historical sequence of events. This is in response to specific developments drawing upon particular memories and traditions. As one New Testament scholar put it, and I think very well, he said this, you can fillet the teachings from the narrative spine of the fish, and you'll have a mass of ideas that can be chopped up and served as fish sticks, but you will no longer have a fish. Prime examples of those things are the Left Behind series, the late great Planet Earth, and all these dispensational things. Yeah, you can pick and choose little bits of information about somebody called Antichrist and something called the Rapture, and you can swirl all this together and produce a book about the end times like the late great Planet Earth. And you will have, you know, something like that, but you will not have the view of the New Testament. Also, the language and words and images that we read in Mark 13, these words are borrowed from the Older Testament, especially from the books of Psalms and the prophets like Daniel and Ezekiel. So these words that we have just read in Mark 13, 1-13, and the rest of the chapter, they have not been freshly minted just for the purposes of the New Testament. So we've got to deal with the reality that the language and the imagery that has been borrowed from the Older Testament is not without consequence. Because it points us to a previously used set of images and metaphors and word phrases from that Old Testament context. These are words that have a significant impact on how we are to best understand what we are reading in Mark 13. And let's just consider an example. Look at verse 12. Mark 13, 12. Now brother will betray brother to death, and the father his child, and the children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. Now the typical way these verses are understood by our dispensational friends is that it describes a time, and the implication they always give you is it's probably the time in which you are living that indicates that we are very close to the rapture or the return of Christ. People see the lurid and the morbid news stories about family violence, and then they read this text and they make that assumption. And that's a prime example of what we are to be warned about earlier. Beginning in the 21st century and reading back into the first century rather than starting in the first and moving forward. Now, our Old Testament reading today was from the book of Micah. Did you notice? Do you remember? Micah 7, verse 6, "For son dishonors father, daughter rises against her mother, daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, a man's enemies are the men of his own household." So you see, Jesus didn't simply invent what he says in Mark 13. This was not said to make sure that prophecy experts in the 21st century will be able to scare people that the rapture and the Antichrist are coming. These words have a history and a context going all the way back to prophet Micah. And Micah had specific purposes in using those words that were concerned with the political and religious climate of his time, and Jesus has used them for the same reasons in his time. Also, the very fact that the words and images in Mark 13 are borrowed from a previously highly significant source of writing, that should raise an immediate red flag for us. And that red flag is all about how the New Testament depicts future events. So we need to look over here, the Old Testament, in order to best understand what's happening over there in the New Testament. So we need to think about the links between Old and New Testament prophetic verses less in terms of there being the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy, and in this case at least, more in terms of these prophetic things being reapplied in that New Testament context. The prophetic words are borrowed from the Old Testament by Jesus and the other New Testament writers in order to say something about a new state of affairs, a different state of affairs going on at their time. Look again at verse 14, Mark 13, 14. Well, I said look again, we didn't actually read that verse, but let's look at verse 14. "So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel the prophet standing where it ought not, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." Now, listen to Daniel 12, 11. From the time that the daily sacrifice is abolished and the abomination that causes desolation is set up, there'll be 1,290 days. So in Daniel, those words refer to an event that actually took place in the year 168 B.C. And you may recall when we did our study through the book of Daniel some months ago, that event was when the Greek ruler Antiochus Epiphanes attacked the Jews, invaded Jerusalem, and destroyed the city and the temple, where he set up an altar to the Greek god Zeus, and he sacrificed a pig on the altar of the temple. So in putting this, Jesus is not denying that the words in Daniel did in fact refer to events in the 2nd century B.C. No, instead, he is borrowing those same words in order to characterize the judgments that were coming upon Jerusalem in that time and in that generation. Now, what I've shared with you today, as I said at the beginning, has been rather academic. But this material is, as I said also before, simply of vital, vital importance. Dr. R.C. Sproul, in his comments on these and other verses like Matthew 24, has made the interesting point that it's often these words in this chapter, this very chapter, that atheists and agnostics have used to cast doubt on the authority of Scripture and the authority of Jesus. Because it's very plain, as we see and will see, that Jesus says something very significant and definitive about his return, quote unquote, in that generation. And so the skeptics, and Dr. Sproul mentioned specifically the British philosopher Bertrand Russell, obviously this man is mistaken because he didn't return at that time. And he said clearly it would be in that generation. So it's important that we really spend some time on this. However, in an effort to help us see that this is not all about academics, it's much more than that, let me leave you with a couple of thoughts about this connection between the prophetic imagery in the Old Testament and how Jesus applies it in the New Testament era. Both the Old Testament prophets and Jesus spoke their words to a generation in crisis. They spoke of a judgment that was coming in their generation, in their time. And the message of Jesus to his followers was essentially one of encouragement to persevere, Because in the end, God will have the victory. Friends, there is no situation in your life that cannot be redeemed if you will trust it to God and turn it over to Him. You see, turmoil and change can be used to God's glory. Change and upheaval can be an opportunity for you to grow in faith, hope, and love. I think I may have told this story once before, but it's worth repeating here. I think most of us have seen the classic award-winning motion picture Ben-Hur, you know, starring Charlton Heston, among others. Well, when they began filming that movie, the great director Cecil B. DeMille told Charlton Heston, the star of the movie, about this all-important chariot race at the end of the film. And he decided that Heston should actually learn how to drive the chariot himself rather than using a stuntman, a stunt double. And Heston agreed to take chariot driving lessons to make the movie as authentic as possible. And he said later, learning to drive a chariot with four horses abreast was not that easy. And after extensive work and days of practice, Heston returned to the movie set and he told Mr. DeMille, he said, "Sir, I think I can drive that chariot okay now, but I'm not at all sure that I can win the race." And with a wry smile on his face, Cecil B. DeMille said, "Heston, you just stay in the race. I'll make sure that you win." My friends, in a sense, those are the words of God to everyone who's going through a time of tumultuous change or challenge. You stay in the race. I'll make sure you win. Look for God's hand in everything you're dealing with. If you cannot see God's hand in the events themselves, look for His hand in the aftermath when you're putting your life back together. We noted at the very beginning of this chapter, the disciples of Jesus are so impressed by the magnificence of the temple in Jerusalem. And by all accounts, even though this is the second one, Herod's second temple was an astoundingly magnificent structure. These men thought that temple would stand forever. And one of the disciples says, "Look, Jesus, what a large, beautiful building, how these stones are. Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left upon another till all are thrown down." And my friends, that becomes for us a warning about all of life. There's only one thing in this world that is sure, and that is God's love for us as revealed in Christ Jesus and His ultimate victory. Amen.